Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
From movie set to multiplex, it's the business of film with James Cameron Wilson.
Jerry, don't let us for the moon. We have the stars.
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
To infinity and beyond!
Wonderful line when you think about it. This is Simon Rose, and you're listening to The Business of Film, and James Cameron Wilson is here to take us through the box office chart and tell us what has been going on and what we should see and what we should avoid.
We have been having some very exciting weekends of late.
Do you speak for yourself, James Cameron Wilson?
We're talking about box office.
Oh, I see. Right.
Yeah, we're talking about the commercial sector.
I thought it was a salacious suburbia there.
Big films like Napoleon and the new Hunger Games, the prequel, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, have really boosted the box office. I'm just saying that because it is the previous weekend, which were no really big Hollywood epics joining the throng, was down 25% from the previous weekend. But we have had two consecutive jumps in the box office performance. But still, looking, I always try to look on the bright side.
You do.
It's still up 43.7% from the same weekend last year, 2022. So that's good. So at number one, we have Napoleon still, which fell an almighty 64%. It was number one the previous weekend. It still made 1.9 million quid for a total now already after 10 days of 9.3 million. At number two, The Hunger Games, hanging on there, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, which was at number two, down 37%. And it made last weekend 1.7 million for a total of 13 million. At number three, still at number three from last weekend, Disney's Wish, going back to a rather old-fashioned template, down 41%. It still made 1.4 million. For a total now of 4.4. But that's not good news for Disney. But as we say, once the school holidays kick off, then it should get more punters in. Number four, we've got a new film, a very long film called Renaissance, a film by Beyoncé, which is a concert movie, which made 1.1 million. Didn't quite perform as well as the Taylor Swift one. At number five, we've got another concert movie, André Rieu's White Christmas, another hit from the perennially popular Dutch violinist. And this did better than many of his previous films.
He's often in the top 10, and it's usually just one day rather than the whole week, isn't it?
A couple of days here.
Yeah.
And it made 1,002,000 quid, which is pretty jolly good. So, again, looking on the bright side, all top five films made over a million last weekend, in spite of the overall downturn. At number six, we've got a new film called Animal, an extremely violent 18 certificate, 3.5 hour long Hindi action drama, which made 719,000 at 172 screens. And the success story of the weekend is Saltburn, which was at number four, dropped to seven, but still made 3% more money at the box office than the previous weekend for a total now of 3.2 million, which is, of course, is Emerald Fennell's follow-up to Promising Young Woman, although I didn't think it was anywhere near as good. But you haven't seen Promising Young Woman, Simon Rose.
No. I'm too nervous of watching it.
Oh, it's wonderful.
So I hear. I do have a screen, and for a while I will get round to it, but I need to be of a rather sort of more robust state of mind. I like Saltburn more than you, and apparently it's doing reasonably well in the States, I think I read somewhere.
Gosh.
You wouldn't think
it is very funny.
I think they probably think it's a documentary in the States.
It's a salt bone. Yeah, well, that's how we live, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Like that all the time, James. I'm just getting so fed up of champagne parties.
Number eight, we have Elf, which is the 20th anniversary re-release, and they seem to release it anyway.
Every time. 20 years, good grief. Yes.
Which is, of course, with Will Ferrell and James Caan, the late James Caan.
And Zooey Deschanel. That's the reason I watch it.
Zoe, yeah, she's lovely. Very funny. She's
a great singer as well, I think.
She does sing. This is true.
I have one of her albums.
Somebody else who sings at number nine is Brie Larson in The Marvels, who actually has a singing sequence in The Marvels. This is the really disappointing, commercially speaking, Marvel film. It's a bit mad with Brie Larson and Gary Lewis, which is... two names I never thought I'd say in the same breath.
Yes, absolutely.
Down 55%. Really disappointing for Marvel. For a total now of £7 million.
Great party game, by the way, James. I'm sure you would think of it anyway. For your friends. Yes, which films combine these two unlikely actors?
Yes, Marlon Brando and Thora Hird, off the top of my head.
What? What?
Marlon Brando. Oh, that's great. Second billing. She gets second billing.
Well, hang on. Then Brando and Thor. Tell us at the end. Let the listeners think about that one while we continue. I'll have
Brando
to think.
And Hurd together.
Brando and Hurd for the first time. Yes. Yes. The last. I should think. Yes. Okay. Right. Well, so that's all 10. Dead. That's all 10 then.
Trolls Band Together is at number 10, which was at number 7, down 52% for a total of 15.3 million. Now, I do want to talk about a film which is still out there. It's on a limited release in the UK, but it has been gathering Oscar momentum. And I made an extra effort to track it down last week because I really wanted to see it. And for our American listeners, and we do have American listeners, it is already available on Netflix in the US. The film is called May, December, and it's directed by Todd Haynes. Now, I think it is no coincidence that the very famous actress, Oscar-winning actress, Natalie Portman, the actress that she plays in May, December is called Elizabeth. No coincidence. Elizabeth was the name of the famous actress that Liv Ullmann played in Ingmar Bergman's Persona, one of the most influential works in the history of world cinema. In Persona, Elizabeth becomes almost indistinguishable from Alma, the woman played by Bibi Anderson, who moves in with her. Here, Natalie Portman's Elizabeth is a very famous committed actress who has been asked to play Gracie in a new film, the latter played by Julianne Moore. At first, we don't know why Gracie is famous or why anybody would want to make a film about her. But Elizabeth wants to get the details right to be able to represent Gracie truthfully. We first see her arriving at Gracie's home in Savannah, Georgia, for a barbecue with the family, and everything would appear to be perfectly normal, as much as the circumstances would demand. Gracie doesn't seem too intimidated by Elizabeth's presence or her fame, although her daughter and her friends do seem in awe. But Elizabeth is used to this and accepts her instant recognition around town, as I suspect Natalie Portman would in real life. She seems free to ask questions and meet Gracie's first husband for coffee, and she goes to the pet shop where Gracie used to work. But gradually, as the layers are peeled away, we realise that Grace's local fame is more a case of notoriety, and not everybody, 23 years on, has forgiven her. Elizabeth is 36, the age that Gracie was when she committed the act that made her famous. Her husband, who we initially presumed to be her son, Joe, is also 36 and is played by the American Korean actor Charles Melton, and as Elizabeth becomes closer to Joe and to Gracie, she starts playing out, in secret, the emotional highlights of her subject's past. This is Julianne Moore's fifth film with the director, Todd Haynes, following Safe, Far From Heaven, I'm Not There, and the wonderful Wonderstruck. She obviously serves as something of a muse for the director, while the cinema itself has proved a constant source of inspiration for Todd Haynes. He's never less than an interesting filmmaker, although there is a kind of self-consciousness to his direction, always paying homage to Hollywood's past, that I find can distract from the drama playing out on the screen. And there's the odd shot where I think, ah, yeah, this is Haynes doing his bit. But he's got himself a wonderful screenplay here by Sammy Birch and has drawn terrific performances from Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore, both of whom are being hotly tipped for Oscar nominations. Sammy Birch has based Gracie on the real-life Mary Kay Letourneau, blending fact with fiction in a most seductive manner, commenting on celebrity in its many forms. And like all good screenplays, it doesn't overplay its hand, nudging its way gently into the psyche of these two women who could not be more unalike, but begin to reflect each other in their mannerisms and choice of clothing, but never in a blatant, obvious manner. I think it's one of those films that keeps you completely enthralled throughout, although the drama never really, for me anyway, truly ignites. However, it does stay with you. And as it does so, the layers continue to sort of unwrap themselves in your head.
So you were glad you made the effort to see it.
I am very glad I made the effort to see it, yes. And I think Natalie Portman in particular is terrific. Now, I know we're running out of time.
Well, we're going to take a break now, James.
That's a very good idea.
So we'll be back in just a moment.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
This is Simon Rose. You're listening to The Business of Film with James Cameron Wilson. He's just been talking about May, December. So it's just May, December, not May to December.
It's May, December. And I'm not entirely sure why it's called May, December.
Okay, well,
I have no idea.
Doesn't seem a terribly catchy title, but I know there's a Blu-ray you want to discuss later, but where are we going first?
Well, this film is actually streaming, so we're going to do films in a hard top, films to streaming, and films on Blu-ray and DVD this week.
Okay.
Quite a selection. This film is called She Came to Me, and it's the story, I mentioned the word muse before, this is the story of a muse. She, the muse, coming to the opera composer Stephen Loudham, who is suffering from writer's block, at precisely the right time to unlock his imagination. Peter Dinklage plays Stephen Loudham, and he has top billing, although the film is about a lot more than just music and writer's block. Although I would have been quite happy to run with that theme, as it's a subject one seldom encounters, if ever, in a movie. An opera composer getting writer's block. And As She Came to Me is written and directed by Rebecca Miller. It is reasonable to expect something grounded in humanity as well as something totally original. Great art, like opera and indeed film, can draw its inspiration from anywhere. And the story starts rolling literally when an opera composer and a tugboat captain walk into a bar.
I've heard that one.
They meet, they talk, and their lives are transformed. The tugboat captain, Katrina Trento, is played by Marissa Tomei, who is the polar opposite to the nervy, faint-hearted, educated, imperious Stephen Loudham. But although the spheres in which they exist could hardly be further apart, they are both human beings, and in this instance, are both recovering from mental episodes. He from depression and a nervous breakdown. She has been banned from seeing rom-coms. But She Came to Me has other characters in the mix, including Stephen's wife, Patricia, played by Anne Hathaway, who is a psychiatrist and a germaphobe. She and Stephen live with the latter's 18-year-old son, Julian, an environmentalist, who is in love with Teresa, a 16-year-old student whose stepfather is a court reporter and a fanatical American Civil War
reenactor. This sounds like somebody tried to summarize a soap opera.
I love the idea that people of such different stripes, both emotionally and professionally, can live alongside each other, particularly in a world like Brooklyn, New York, where most of the action takes place. But wherever you are, in whichever suburban street, everybody is different and yet connected by such basic human fears and functions. And I was looking at my own neighbors after I saw this. And so gradually, she came to me, ventures into the worlds of music, high art, psychiatry, cleaning, stalking, historical reenactments, nymphomania, religion, addiction, infidelity, statutory rape, and the life of a tugboat captain who conveys airplane parts and shower curtains from place to place. There are a couple of lines of dialogue I jotted down because they seemed so germane to the person uttering them, such as when Stephen screams at an opera singer that she is smudging the syncopation, which you can sort of imagine an opera composer using that sort of terminology. Likewise, when Patricia argues that your frontal lobe doesn't fully develop until you're 25, you suspect that she knows what she's talking about. Hence, one gets the impression that these are very real people who exist in real worlds of their own understanding, and that Rebecca Miller, let us not forget, the daughter of the playwright Arthur Miller, has really done her homework, had done her research there.
Don't think you said which service it was on.
Sky Cinema and Now TV, a very important question. Thus, there are a lot of interesting moving parts here, which enticingly fall into place and impact on each other, resulting in a hugely refreshing, surprising, I think insightful, and very funny and credible farce. We talked about farce recently, and this is farce because you just can't believe what's happening on screen. But all the actors retain that plausibility, which is so essential for great farce.
And very difficult for farce because, I saw Noises Off not that long ago. And the problem is that doesn't work anymore because the plays that it's based on don't exist. So it doesn't have that air of reality. Very difficult to do with farce, I think.
I was very, very happily surprised by this. I've always liked Rebecca Miller. And of course, she's married to somebody who's inhabited many different lives, Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh, right. Yes. Has he really given up for good now?
He's not going back on his word.
So, James, you want to talk about a Blu-ray. Can I just mention something quickly before we start?
I've discovered
a great film resource. I often, when you talk about films or when I think about old films, I often look to see if they're up on streaming services, and quite often they aren't, or I don't subscribe to the right one. I found a place for looking at for radio programs in the past called archive.org, which I think is an American system, and it's great for audio, but I've discovered they also do films, a lot of classic movies, and movies that were made in the 20s, 30s and 40s, which aren't terribly well known. Lots of film noir, lots of romantic comedies, all free to download. Some of them are weird and have Spanish subtitles, but doesn't seem to bother me. But anyway, if you're looking for a film, even a British one, and it's obscure, or you can't find it anywhere else, worth having a look. Anyway, James, you want to talk about
A Blu-ray. Point,
oh, sorry.
I had an overwhelming desire to watch Battleship Potemkin yesterday, as one does. And I just typed into YouTube, Battleship Potemkin HD, and the whole film is there in HD.
Oh, right. Yes. Well, of course, YouTube is another great resource. And of course, if it's out of copyright, then no reason to think it won't be there.
Yeah.
I found one film on, I can't even remember what it was now. I found one extraordinary film from the 50s there, quite a well-known film, so it's gone out of my mind. And it was on archive.org. And the explanation was that the film company had forgotten to put the copyright notice on it. So it was out of copyright the moment it came out. How can you believe that? But somebody lost their job pretty quickly,
it's
I think.
It's a strange world.
Anyway,
we live
Blu-ray.
Past Lives.
Mm-hmm.
I know I don't review many foreign language films on this show, but when I do, I am invariably taken aback by how intelligent and nuanced they are, like Anatomy of a Fall recently. On one level, Past Lives seems a very simple, perhaps even straightforward, document of a Korean woman. But once you start to peel away those layers, there is so much more to take away with you.
Mm-hmm.
What is even more remarkable about this philosophical, reflective, poetic, and achingly romantic piece is that it is the directorial debut of Celine Song. Released on DVD and Blu-ray this week, Past Lives boasts the usual array of enticing extras, including deleted scenes and interviews with the director and cast, and an enlightening audio commentary. The film is described as semi-autobiographical, and like her female protagonist, Nora, Celine Song was born in South Korea, emigrated to Ontario with her parents at the age of 12, and ended up in New York City, married to a Jewish playwright. In the Blu-ray's bonus material, Song looks absurdly young, 18 at a pinch, but she's actually 35. On the audio commentary, she talks of how emotional scenes, how many scenes got so emotional that both her leads, Greta Lee and Teo Yu, cried on camera, which she cut because in spite of its emotional tenor, that was not the kind of thing she wanted to put on film. Mm. And I mean film. It's not. It's actually shot on film, not digital. So, Nora Young, the character in the film, dreamed of winning the Nobel Prize, but once in Toronto, she fine-tunes her ambition, dreaming of the Pulitzer, and when another 12 years later she finds herself in New York, she thinks it'll be cool to win the Tony. Celine Song is not Nora Young, or Na Young when she starts out, but her first film has already won 11 major awards, last week winning the Best First Film Award from the New York Film Critics Circle. Meanwhile, the Hollywood trade magazine Variety is predicting that it will be nominated for Best Picture. And the opening is brilliant. Three people are sitting in a bar, that bar scene again, talking. And initially, I thought my Blu-ray copy was out of sync, as the words I heard didn't match the mouths of the people speaking. We then realize that the threesome are being observed by a third party, wondering how the Asian woman in the middle, with an Asian man to her right and a Jewish man to her left, could be connected. And the film is so much about connection. There is a Korean concept called in-yun, which suggests that the connections we make in this life, however apparently casual, are actually echoes of previous connections in past lives, looping back thousands of years. The film then cuts back 24 years to Seoul in South Korea, where Na Young, as she's known then, and Hae Sung are 12-year-old classmates who are encouraged to go on a one supervised date, which turns into this magical day. But shortly afterwards, Na Young and her parents emigrate to Canada, and Na and Hae Sung are perhaps too young to know how to say goodbye properly. Things were different then, but they had already forged this incredible bond. 12 years later, though, through a cyber fluke, they are reunited on Facebook and embark on a series of wonderfully intimate conversations, each one trying to persuade the other to visit Seoul or to visit New York. But they now have their own lives, and the prospect seems impossible. But by this stage, their relationship is dictated by the beeps and ringtones of social networking, primarily Skype, when Nora, as she is now known, suggests they terminate their discourse so that they can both pursue their separate lives. Nora, in particular, wanting to concentrate on her writing, like the director, Celine Song.
Mm.
Of course, there is a third chapter when, following another 12 years, Heisung does travel to New York. Much of the story, particularly its resonance, is built on the visuals that accompany it, along with Christopher Baer and Daniel Rossen's exquisite score. But whereas, say, a film like Richard Linklater's Before Trilogy is largely propelled by dialogue, Past Lives is often propelled by what isn't said or expressed, which I think makes it all the more poignant. I have already set aside an evening later this month to see it again, the better to unpick the illusions and subtleties I missed the first time round, why the camera moves the way it does, why Celine Song frames one particular scene the way she does. And she does it with the lightest of touches, with a sweet, gentle, and beautiful hand, as if painting her story with images rather than words, the framing in particular taking on its own cinematic punctuation. I absolutely love this movie.
James, thank you very much indeed. That's it for this week from James Cameron Wilson. He'll be back, though, with more at the same time next week.
I want to be alone.
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?